So, as the chair of education for the Society of Musculoskeletal Medicine, I assume you'll be teaching us all about traction, frictions, and why and how to inject everything. Is that right, Johnny?
Oh, that's well, thank you, Jack. That's a good introduction. I think if that's the maybe thoughts that some people might have about SOM, that all about friction and injection, everything in traction, then I'm really glad to be here today and given this opportunity to set the record straight and maybe debunk a few myths and talk about how society's maybe evolved and changed a bit over the years. I think I'd have hoped we might be talking about how SOM provides kind of high quality MSK education at master's level to a multi-professional audience, which I think is important in a collaborative and pragmatic way, but very happy to talk about frictions and injections.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think what's good there is that we've got it out of the way, the history, the stereotypes, be that fair or not, as well as then the movement of the organization towards what you've just described, which of course then describes as you feel it is on the tin now. But let's just throw to that history if we can then. And so why might I say that? Why obviously saying it through a smirk, but why do those things exist? Because I know, I'll admit that I had some of those associations at least, even though I knew that I'm sure many of them are dated.
Yeah, no, I think there's a certain fairness to it. I think back, I mean, I did the courses now, I don't know, 17, 18 years ago. And a lot of the treatment techniques taught were transverse frictions, and the principles were, if it's a chronic lesion, you'll do it for 10 minutes, kind of post analgesia, and there'd be injections for quite a lot of lesions. And the traction might be recommended for certain types of mechanical back pain. So in the past, those certainly have been taught techniques, and I think they've been taken out of proportion how they've been meant to have been. But certainly in recent years, we've changed the emphasis on those techniques, in light with evidence and in light with student feedback too.
And what's your journey been within the organization then? What's your story as well as then, the organization in recent years as you've been involved?
Yeah, well, my story, I'm a physiotherapist. I think back now, I think I was fortunate to do these courses 2 to 3 years post-qualified, because it really gave me a solid foundation, solid clinical reasoning, and clinical examination to really build my roots in MSK. And I really enjoyed the courses. I loved the courses. I went on to do the master's degree with SOM, went on to then get an extended scope physio job in the NHS. And then I did the injection therapy courses and then the fellowship course, and I started teaching with the society back in 2008. So it's been integral to my career, and it's been really helpful at all those different stages, as a more junior physio, as an extended scope physio. When you're in an environment with shorter appointment times, you need the really condensed, precise assessment and clinical reasoning, and having the options of injection therapy, if appropriate, or knowledge of diagnostic imagery has been really useful. And in the last 10 years, I've been in private practice, and I utilize assessment and treatment techniques from SOM pretty much every day. But as we teach on the courses, combine it with all sorts of other approaches, other techniques, it's just one part of the kind of clinical toolbox, really.
Brilliant. And so on this, in the spirit of sort of cleaning up potential myths and misconceptions, as well as potentially even if needs be, defending certain types and styles of practice in this wide landscape in MSK, of which it is, let's think this almost assessment and treatment techniques. Let's separate them off. They're never cleanly separated, but there's I think on the assessment side, I think that I would associate some, rightly or wrongly, again, with a level of specificity or methodology that's almost recipe-like or protocol-like in a sense that we can always think about the pros and cons of having a style, right? And that's something I'm sure we'll get onto. But I'm just wondering, like, how much of that do you think, both in terms of history as well as now, is a reasonable way of categorizing some relative to, either other frameworks or other styles of reasoning?
I think there is a certain pathway we certainly follow when teaching the courses, and it does relate back some of the principles to Dr. James Syriacs. And some people who are more experienced clinicians will probably be aware of maybe the Syriacs method or the Syriacs approach, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And when we, he came across this process of assessment, diagnosing and treating non-surgical MSK conditions, really using principles of selective tissue tension, which might seem fairly obvious to us now, but with our objective examination, it's going through a certain order of doing your, you know, your passive movements, your active movements, your resistor tests, neurological tests. And with the subjective history, when we teach it, we do teach it in a similar format in regards, you know, looking at different headings, at age, occupation, sports, hobbies, lifestyles, flight and spread of symptoms, the onset and duration, the ags and eases, the 24-hour patterns, medical history, social history. But what we say is that certainly when you become more confident, you let the patient speak. You know, you let the patient speak and don't interrupt them with things. But I think certainly when you're a less experienced clinician, making sure you don't miss those things is important. And we really focus on the clinical relevance and importance of all those headings. But you're right, we do teach in a certain way. But I think in the past, there might have been the impression that, oh, you had to do it in a specific order, specific handling, otherwise you'd be pulled up. And you know, for example, now if someone prefers to do their reflexes a different way or got a slightly different handling approach or do their resistor test differently, as long as what they do is accurate, then that would be absolutely fine in our exams.
Yeah, I think that that's where it's pleasing to hear a sort of liberalization of that where, and you know, the MACP ended up having a not dissimilar reputation, almost like there were different flavors of Masonic handshake that you did or didn't learn. And that, and they were, instead of a handshake, it was a particular handling technique to do a range of movement of a hip, when fundamentally, you know, much like our neuro colleagues went on to learn that, you know, function matters more than the delicacies, and that fundamentally we need to find out what that range is, and that there are good and bad ways of doing that, but there's probably a few we can pick from rather than one shape. So glad to hear of maturity in that direction. Onto treatments, we've kind of alluded to different styles there where that are some might be known for, or more so, or Syriac was. And we can get into the detail on it, but I think what I'm most interested in is whether or not you feel it'd be fair for me to wonder, is it as interventional by design as it was, you know, doing two people rather than, say, with and being more rehab-centric? Not that those are perfect contrast, because we know that there's adjuncts, et cetera, and integrated practice, but just as a general rule, is it quite an interventional style?
Well, I think there's certain taught techniques. So, for example, with the treatment techniques, yes, we go through transverse frictions, we go through graded mobilizations, and grade A, B, and C, which is only manipulation, and we talk about injection therapy. But when we put it into clinical relevance, you know, let's say we're you're rehabbing a tendinopathy. So with tendons, our thoughts on frictions certainly have changed, in as far as if you've got a persistent tendinopathy. Do we think transverse frictions potentially have a role? For some people, possibly, but our rationale for that is more of an analgesic response to facilitate loading and rehab. So we've listened to our audience, and we add in rehab, do like a little rehab masterclass on the final day where we'll go over rehab ideas for common pathologies. But we'll say, well, look, you know, if you've got someone with a painful tendon and you've got a technique at your hands that can give an analgesic response, which can then facilitate rehab. But also, I think it's the power of being able to modulate someone's symptoms. Because if you can do something and you can change their symptoms, then you can get a lot of buy-in from the patient. You start to build right. trust in the patient, and then they trust and respect you. And then when you say, well, actually, yeah, what we now need to really do is look at your lifestyle factors there and do active rehab there and get you moving more, look at you more holistically. But frictions aren't the treatment, but they can be a helpful adjunct for the person.
And so with that, because it's an interesting thing I haven't thought about for a long time, really, frictions. And so when it was always going to come up with us, it got me to thinking, the mechanism of effect of these interventions, we've kind of come to understand better across the board. But with something like frictions, by design, they were kind of originally touted as being that you're breaking down adhesions, and don't worry, yes, it hurts, and but it'd be worth it. And also then, even on a neurological level, it was implied that it was a sort of the neurological version. I'm going to miss the wording, but it's like a strain counter strain, or you're provoking pain as a means of analgesic effect. And so we've kind of learned a lot on that in such a way that it's like, I can't think of a way in which I would manage a tendon that would look or sound or behave anything like what I knew as frictions, enough to still call them frictions, right? Yeah, I can comprehend a reason for therapeutic touch of that region, but you know what I mean? It's almost like eventually, unless you're going to tell me actually the technique still exists, that it's not dissimilar and it's the reasoning that's changed, which I need to get my head around, and I'll ask some more questions. But if it is relevantly different in its actual technique, then begs the question whether the name's fair, because there ain't a lot of friction between tissues that we know that.
I think they get really bad press of being a painful technique, painful for the patient, painful for the therapist, persistent. Not at all. I mean, when I teach, I will often talk about a general ladder effect. So you start off, so you know you're on the correct spot. Then when you get an analgesic response, if you're down to the target depth, then for me, from say tendon point of view, it is more of probably the mechanoreceptor stimulation, the A beta fiber stimulation, the short lasting pain gate effect. Probably we've taken out the slides on breaking down adhesions. You know, we know tendons don't like compression, it's a bit different from tendons than maybe a muscle belly or something. But we really don't friction tendons for a long time, and are always a precursor to some other form of treatment. But there was actually, whilst this is a different kind of story, because it was for it was a lady with an early OA thumb. But if I may just share this story, because it just happened like last week. This lady came to see me originally 5 years ago with an early OA thumb, trapezio first metacarpal. She had a capsular restriction, had a grind test positive, early OA thumb, and we know with an OA thumb, that first metacarpal can get pulled round and it get a bit tight anteriorly. So I did a few minutes of just transverse frictions on that anterior capsule, and followed it up with a bit of a grade B mobilization, an early stretch, which gave us some pain relief and then lots of advice. And anyway, she came to see me, last week or so with a neck problem. I was like, oh, how's your thumb? She went, it's fine. She went, that technique you taught me to do, if it gets a bit sore, I do a little bit of that, give it a gentle stretch, and then carry on. So it was really interesting that actually, with the appropriate patient, giving someone a pain-relieving technique, she's found really useful and has managed it, and it's not progressed over the last 4 to 5 years. So a bit of an attendance, because that's more...
No, but I think I can understand that, because I was talking about the technique sort of somewhat independent of the condition. I think that... Rubbing sore tendons or what have you, I definitely need to think further in that direction. It's not something I've given a lot of thought to recently, and possibly I'd argue because I've not suddenly felt a need to. It's not like I'm capping out my outcomes by not doing so. That's one of the things that's interesting. But I think one of the things that definitely interests me is then whether we can really have a mature conversation about the integration of various different adjuncts and modalities. But where I think the pandemic really moved me on this, and I've been pretty open about it on the podcast, where, the movement to that age-old hands-on, hands-off debate, which I think we've matured on to some degree, but the real test that was how distant we ended up having to be when we were trying to treat people through screens meant that even the ones that weren't particular manual therapists like myself, certainly recognized the importance of touch from a handshake to the laying of hands to a thorough examination to even some techniques of which we were trying to do for pain relief. And I think that then that's where we need to make sure we're careful to not be dismissive. I think that it's hard for me in these sorts of conversations to not, though, wonder where the line is. It becomes then, once we're in that gray area and we're recognizing that, it's really unhealthy to say, lay your hands and lay hands on everyone and lay hands on no one. And we're all like, no, some of the time, some things, toolbox, right. So we get there, and it sounds like you and I are both there. But where do you guys, as some, go about trying to work out what does or doesn't meet a threshold for, say, it being taught? Is that because of the sort of legacy and the history and these modalities sit within our scope or history and these don't? Or where do you go looking for the reason that something meets a threshold for, say, a syllabus or curriculum?
I think it is a really tricky one, because we do say you've got to meet your patient at their story. You've got to treat each individual on an individual basis, but you've also got to provide clinicians with a framework to work from. And I think that's what some is really strong with, the clinical reason and the clinical examination, and being able to formulate a diagnosis and treatment plan. We're very clear with the certain treatments we provide. In itself, that's not enough to adequately treat someone. And you know, it's looking at that person holistically, and we do integrate it with rehab. We do integrate, because we have multi-professional courses, it's brilliant when you've got a podiatrist on there, when you've got an osteopath on there, when you've got a sports therapist on there. And we ask people as a group, and as a tutor, I always try and suss out people's strengths and say, right, what would you like to contribute? So the discussions and conversations go in all sorts of different avenues. We discuss all sorts of different treatment interventions. We're just providing, you know, a small reference point of some things we think can be useful.
One of the things I was pleased to hear in recent years from people like Neil Langridge, when he was on the formulation of the roadmap, is keeping me up to speed on that for various reasons, including knowing that there came a point where it was smart for us to broadcast and shout about it together, and have worked on it on various levels since, is that APPN, MACP and SOM were collaborating and continue to on all things from supervisor courses and all that sort of stuff, and committing some of this to mapping on what is now the MSK roadmap, of which we can signpost people if they're not knowing what I'm on about, but they're listening to this podcast, I'd be surprised. It comes up often. But the reason I bring that up with you is partly, like I said, I was pleased to see that further collaboration, anti-tribal, all the things I'm really into. But also, I just wanted to ask you, how big a decision was that? And how simple was it for you to go about doing that? Was that a massive change of course? Or was that something that actually it fed in well, because all those organizations I've mentioned are kind of maturing towards a common evidence base?
Yeah, I think it was a very easy integration. I think within our society, we don't have any particular strong big egos in there. We want to look at collaboration. And I think the roadmap's been a really good one. And it's great that our foundation diploma in musculoskeletal medicine is fully mapped against the KSA for the stage one roadmap. So we're getting quite a lot of people come on the courses now, because they want to use it as their evidence. But it was great going to the MSK conference, you know, at the NEC last year, and all being in a row with MACP, APPN and us there, and going out for a meal and a beer afterwards. And that was really good. And that's where we see the future, really. We want to integrate more, collaborate more to benefit, you know, physios and ultimately the society.
Now, I've a question to that effect then, just thinking about the history of how all these things have come about. You know, I know pretty well from the work we did with MSKR and stuff, and looking back over that, and there's no way that that's not relevant. And that then intersects with professions as well, you know, osteos and chiros and our sports therapy colleagues and stuff like that. But the more that more of us are talking like this, and I do totally understand why, then I end up being more of a lumper than a splitter. You know, I end up making people a bit twitchy when I suggest, you know, how long until we're all MSK therapists? We talk about it being various different stripes. That's on the professional level. But then let's just say on the sort of organizational front, you know, does that end up meaning that a lot of that identity starts to melt away, and that collaboration looks deeper and deeper and stuff? I'm not pressurizing you to do it now, by the way, at all, but I'm just meaning, did you see into the future and you see there being high profile mergers and for us to start looking at that being more broadly, that's the stronger together movement isn't just collaboration, it is an ever closer union that becomes harder and harder to see the differences and clearness of lines?
I think so. I mean, It is difficult to foresee the future there. I think different organisations have different ideas and different strengths and potential weaknesses. But you know, I would be all for that kind of potential future outlook. So yeah, I think it's been great in recent years having that collaboration. So yeah, I'm quite open to things with that.
One of the things that we've spoken about ahead of this podcast, which certainly made me you know, deeply reflective of the past, is that the next generation of therapists, I've said on this show before, unfortunately, for various reasons, and I think COVID, I said this, I thought it was a quote I'd been using since COVID, and then someone said, here's you 3 years before COVID saying it on a podcast, was that you're getting graduates that can pontificate the shortcomings of an RCT but not do a Lachman's. It was like a meme that someone had made or some sort of quote thing that they were holding me to, and I thought it was a COVID thing. I thought it was me describing the clinical distance that had kind of been mandated of universities, but apparently no, I was feeling a similar way long before the pandemic. Now, one of the things that I think I realized that when we were doing a lot of early physiomatter stuff is that we were so concerned about the rigidity of frameworks and pathways and expectations to go in a particular direction and pick a team, pick a tribe, that we then were just sort of saying, no, the jigsaw pieces lay their land and we're pretty good at bringing this together and therefore that doesn't matter. And learn the skills, fine, but you know, don't need the framework, anti-framework. And I realize now that me, and I look at that early physio matters team, and I know that I still know now that we happen to be pretty good at building the jigsaws, right? That we wouldn't find that difficult. And we therefore thought we were of our audience and we were like everyone else. And then over time, we heard from more and more people saying, how do I bring this together? People reaching out for mentorship to try. That was the actual, the thing that we're most struggling with, was the thing that we were actually stronger at, which was fine for us as educators, but it was naive of us to potentially throw the baby out with the bathwater on that. We thought we were being more calculated with our critique when we were actually being more clumsy. And I think that I realize now that, especially in those early days, we were potentially overly dismantling some of the scaffolding. I'm extending this metaphor, but I think you probably follow. Is that is something that I look on at and think, I hope that some and others are finding ways to keep some of that framework, of which I think I was clumsy in, not dismantling, I'm not saying I did that, but I'm just meaning like that the critique was a clumsy enough to potentially suggest that they weren't as useful as they maybe were for some people. But then also not keeping all the dressing that was around it, that was part of why it was so vulnerable to critique. So I just wondered if I could get your reflections on that and how you see your audience and your society and your membership valuing structure without overindulging rigidity.
I think that's a really good point. And I think when I reflect back from my own personal experience of doing the courses and the course feedback we've had personally for the last 15 years of teaching, we hear so many times, and also actually when people do their reflective essay to get their diploma after Unit 3, don't know how many times I've heard someone say, do you know what, coming on the course was like a light bulb moment, because it was... And I think it's harder nowadays. In some respects, it's a lot better in some respects that we've got access to podcasts and webinars and all these things on social media, which is brilliant. I love going for a jog and listening to a podcast. But you've got so many things. And I guess what I would liken it to is like almost like an MSK tree. You know, I think, and what I've heard from people coming on the courses is that we've given them some clarity. We've given them a framework. We've given them some clinical reasoning, some ability to diagnose, going over anatomy again, surface anatomy, but making functional relevant sense. Because when it's taught at undergraduate level, you've got no patient mileage to make sense of it. So going over anatomy again and improving palpation skills, going over clinical examination, but really going into deep depth of subjectives, because we all know if you do a good subjective, you know, 70% of the time, you should have a really good idea of what that diagnosis is. Good objective examinations, and then some useful treatment techniques. And so many times people reflect back saying, coming on this course, it gives you the roots, it gives you the foundation, it gives you the anchor to then go in. What I would say is build your tree, build all these branches with going on, you know, webinars and podcasts, and let that develop your MSK tree. But if you don't have the solid roots, then when you've got a complex patient or when you come into a difficult situation, you can really question yourself and get a bit confused. So that's where I see some, and when I reflect back, the light bulb moments people have said, you've given me clarity to then build from.
I agree with all of that. And I look forward to understanding and delving further into some to know more about that. we'll talk a bit about your injection courses as well, as I think, and the way that like links to quality anatomy, because I think that that's where people have been complacent. Now, I definitely want to flag that to come back to. But before I do, when I'm agreeing with all of that, I'm also gutted that that's not exactly what an undergraduate bachelor's in any of our named MSK disciplines or associated MSK disciplines should be getting you. So sorry to put you on the spot there, but is part of the reason for us both agreeing on this need and arguably an increasing need for said root and trunk, what's a three-year bachelor's doing as a qualified professional that then gets, by the way, that's not entry level, that's not apprentice, that's registered on the HCPC in the same way as I am now, 20 years qualified or whatever it is. What are we doing if not if in those courses, and do you have a take on that industry, for want of a better term?
Again, I think that's a good point. I think some elements of the course, particularly maybe the examination side, I think that should be undergraduate. I think there's elements of the course, particularly with the newer lectures we've had in, I'll say in that communication skills, that should be undergraduate. But I guess some of the new lectures on pharmacotherapy, onward referral, lifestyle factors, clinical masqueraders might be a little bit too advanced undergraduate, but some components of the clinical reasoning and the clinical examination, I think, could be better at undergraduate level. And yeah, I agree with that.
Are they worsening? Is the gap between what you guys are doing, of which I imagine you'd argue, and I can understand why, that it's that's improving? Is it that the gap's only widening because yours are improving and they're staying still, or are they worsening? Or what's your just general assessment of the landscape on the undergraduate side?
They seem to be, from my personal experience, doing less and less hands-on, certainly from when I reflect back. And I think that's evident when we do these courses and you've got a newly qualified physio, or you've got a physio who's been qualified a couple of years. Over the years, I've noticed a change in people's handling skills. They're not as comfortable handling. The handling's, not as precise. It's not as effective. And they're not as confident. I don't think they're really doing it either in their job as much or at undergraduate.
And it's so interesting, because it's like, I'm so torn, because for so many years, and there's still a bit of this in me now, why I'm sort of squirming a bit, is because I so heard that for so long and just thought that this was a sort of death cry of really specific palpation and manual therapy that had not stood the evidence base, and also hadn't stood what I felt was practice-based evidence. And there was some of that. But then I think that the more recently, I'm realizing that that has now extended to my point about Lachman's and an apprehension test and a hip range of movement assessment and the confident, comfortable handling that is not optional when you're handling a head to assess passive range of a neck. It's mandatory. Otherwise, they can't. If you can't get them to actually commit to the comfort of your hands, you can't assess that properly to really understand it. That's where I'm sort of on. I don't know why this has become an apology podcast for my former self, but that I know that I'm now torn between what I was saying before. I think still had a point. Like there were people and still are people that as soon as they're saying let's hands on, therefore that's inherently bad, because how else would we learn to not crack the shell of an egg, Maitland Moab one type stuff, and then. But as I've just admitted to, it seems to be that as we've done that, we have ended up with this really awkward, clumsy lack of handling. There's surely got to be a way in which we can teach good handling skills without also having to then have this overbearing baggage of exactly the sort of positional perfect way of doing, say, a mobilization or otherwise. And so, an admission for me to just be like, I've got to personally recognize that, I accept, but also as an industry at large, we've got to come to some sort of decision so that we don't underteach, but also that this doesn't all just sound like a cry for yesteryear and all the particulars that we should have moved past, I guess.
It needs a balance, isn't there? Yeah.
What do you think with regards to anatomy, injections, how do you guys go about teaching that, and how is that different to others? You know, because I understand that to be a relevant USP, and I've heard from others in build up to this podcast. I sent a few texts and emails out, and heard that people said that that is an area where they really rate you guys. So, how is it that you guys see yourselves in that space?
Well, we do allocate good time to surface anatomy. We get good cadaveric slides. We've got our good textbook, which helps to give people guidance. And we like to, you know, if you're a visual learner, we like to get the old pens out and draw things on each other to a certain extent. But we try and make it functional anatomy rather than just anatomy for the sake of anatomy. As far as then kind of that goes in, does that answer that question, or do you want me to talk about injections?
No, it does. I mean, do you do either cadaveric images or cadaveric sessions, or do you feel that it needs to be further detailed in that direction?
I mean, the images on our slides are kind of cadavers, and I think that is, people like that. They like to see that, they like to be able to visualize that. And then going straight from seeing the slide to then doing a practical palpation, I think is helpful. And I think that is helpful when people are postgrad, because then they can relate it back to clinical situations more than undergrad. And it makes a bit more sense. They can almost visualize in what they're treating more clearly. So I think that is a strength, but we've got to make it functional and not just do it for the sake of anatomy. But that comes into the, you know, it's useful for injections. I think as far as injections go, does it lend itself to talk about injections now, or?
Yeah, it does. I think I'll just bridge the gap as to why I frame that question that way, I guess, is because I found that a massive jump that I didn't see coming when mentoring, you know, band sixes through to seven, et cetera, especially in the NHS, but I'd still say it stands, but less so now because I'm just interacting with injections. I don't inject anymore, for example, in private practice. I haven't gone through that governance process in the main, and there were less and less of what I did considering the caseload, I see. But back then, I noticed that you get absolutely top drawer clinicians that had become rehab centric, especially working within, say, an increasingly chronic demographic, etc., that they then needed to acquire the skill and the reasoning process under injection therapy, which made sense for them to do, even if they were going to use it sparingly as part of their advanced practice. There, it wasn't revision of anatomy. They'd actually become a massively talented clinician, still were a talented clinician, by the way, but their anatomy was so superficial, their knowledge, it really wasn't, depending on where they'd done their courses and degrees, etc. But I found that to be interesting. So that's the reason I was linking anatomy and the fact that I can see when it comes to sort of your levels and processes, I can so see the real value of coming from that place so that people don't end up feeling very exposed. And I'd argue even dangerous. If your anatomy is that poor, no one should be arming you with a needle. It weirds me out. And there's some people, and most clinicians being appropriately mature about their competence, they did stop themselves. But that's why I framed that question that way, I guess, Johnny, is because that's definitely my opinion and sort of my bias. I wonder if you've seen it that way and whether as an organization you've built things that way for a reason.
Well, definitely. I mean, with our injection therapy course, in the past, you had to have done the foundation diploma before you could do the advanced injection therapy course. Because, of course, with the diploma, the foundation diploma, we teach the principles of injection, but you're not qualified to inject after that course. You've got to do the injection therapy course. But in more recent years, we've said, look, if you're an advanced practitioner working in a situation where you're going to be able to inject and you've done, you know, relevant courses, but not a SOM course, you can come on the course. But what the injection therapy tutors have said is those people who are experienced clinicians but who haven't done the foundation, their knowledge of anatomy, they struggled a lot more with it because they didn't have that knowledge of anatomy, which of course for injection therapy is important. So they have noticed that a difference between cohorts who have gone and done the foundation and those who haven't.
No, it's interesting. And I think it's one of those things that only time will tell, really, or it's hard to know the direction of travel with that, with regards to education standards, because there's such an appropriate proliferation of advanced practice skills under FCP, under the roadmap, under you and others as organisations supporting that work. And so, yeah, it could well be that my concerns are easily allayed by some what is revision. But I just think that this, to some extent, I've witnessed a group that didn't know what they didn't know. You know, they didn't realize they become someone that had become more complacent over anatomy than they'd realized. And I was surprised how much Even as someone that never backed himself as being that particular on anatomy, considering that my style of practice, I still felt like I knew it to unlearn it. And that was very relevant. Whereas there were some that had managed to clearly not really ever know or be bothered. And you kind of do need to know your origins and insertions better once you start putting needles in people. And why wouldn't you? And the anatomy of the knee matters when you're trying to hit that pouch to inject into the knee. It's something I took for granted until I needed that skill. And so it's very interesting. I think that especially with you guys being known for good and bad of injections, I couldn't help but ask that question.
No, I think with our injection course, I think it is, I mean, there's so many injection courses out there. I mean, I don't teach on the injection course, but I think it's regarded as quite a challenging course, but almost like a gold standard course. It was the first one produced or developed in 1999. You know, for physios to do. It's evolved an awful lot. It's changed an awful lot. Each year we update the manuals for all our courses, for foundation and injection. So we change things. Some injections are taken out that used to be in there. You know, we used to have certain, you know, we've taken out the Achilles tendon. We've taken out the patella tendon. We've taken out injecting individual rotator cuff tendons because we've said, look, you know, the fibers interdigitate, they blend together. It can be really hard to be precise with which part of the cuff. So there'd be a general subacromial injection rather than individual tendons. There's debate at the moment, you know, do we use local anesthetic because of potential chondrotoxicity? Some research out there. So should we be using saline or should we be using other things than steroid at times? And there was the whole PRP debate, which has become topical recently with physios, and hyaluronic acid. And so they really do. It's such a malleable, evolving course. And it's been great that we've recently got 5 new injection therapy tutors. And I don't know if I can name drop, but we've got some really influential figures in there. You know, Helen Welch, Amanda Hensman-Crook, Matt Daly, you know, really good, influential people. And I think for them to want to come on board and teach with some, I think says quite a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was pleased to hear that and know of those, of course, but to particularly, you know, Helen's someone I've worked with for a long time and I'm now discerning she is over such things and will have done her due diligence that can sometimes be a really helpful vouch for people that are sometimes spoilt for choice. And so I'm really pleased to hear that and look forward to hearing how they get on as well as what you guys continue to develop. Really excited to see how the organization develops, especially the wider collaborations in the industry. You know, the more accurate the better in my book, of course, and also for us to be able to share with our audience a little bit of an insight into not just your history and your present, but also some of the reasons underneath what you're doing for people that might well be interested in getting involved. So if they are, what's the best way that people could get involved with you guys?
I think the best thing would be to have a look on the website, because I think it depends where you are in your clinical journey, really. I guess we've got the foundation course is the main initial course. But we get a wide variety of people on that because you get some newly qualified, but you get a lot of experienced clinicians wanting it for the FCP pathway or wanting it because they want to be an APP. So I guess if you go onto the website and then you'll be able to see all the courses, the foundation course units 1, 2, and 3, that's worth 60 credits, a third of an MSc, which is a great qualification in itself. There's then the advanced option modules, so the injection therapy, an advance in practice module, about 20 credit modules. So you know, if you've done nothing with SOM before, but you're thinking, look, I'm in a job now where I can inject, then you will be able to come straight onto that injection therapy course. And it's nice now we've come out of the pandemic that we're doing courses throughout the UK again, and not just at our headquarters in Liverpool. So that's nice. Look on the website, but leave a message. I'm very happy for people to email me if they got queries. I'm very happy to discuss to see what might suit them or might be suitable for their situation.
Superb. And what's the best way to get in touch with you then? Are you on social media or email address you're happy to share?
Yeah, I'm happy to share email address. I'm on social media, but I don't do as much as I probably should. But it's my email is Johnny, johnny.smith. at somcourses.org. So very happy for people to email me. So johnny.smith@somcourses.org. But if you go on the website, you can contact, we've just got a brand new practice manager who will be quite responsive. So leave a message on there and I'd be very happy to speak to people.
No, fantastic. And yeah, anyone who wants to get in touch, obviously you can do so via us on socials as well, if you like. I'll happily put you in touch with Som. Been really interesting for me to hear, not just in this podcast, but obviously sidebars with Johnny as well, about where the organization's going and what they're doing. Because as you all know, I've been banging a big kumbaya, let's all get around the same campfire drum for a while. And so some of that was aimed at certain organizations. Som hadn't been as close to my radar as it should have been. And so for that to then have really emerged in this space and for me to hear increasingly good things about them is brilliant, and especially that evolution and reform that is being described, not just of the organization but of all of our wider practices. We aspire to help people with their sore bits and be better at it, means that's all for the good. So thank you for all that you've done, and thanks for coming on the show. It's been great to chat to you.
Thank you very much, Jacko. Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.